You are listening to Gooday World on the Podcast Network. Puny humans must die. You will be baked. And we will have cake.
G'day world, this is Cameron Riley. You're listening to the Podcast Network. It's good to be back, ladies and gentlemen. It's a Monday, and I think I might do shows on a Monday from now on, just like a regular thing. Let's just have a Cameron show on a Monday. What do you reckon? Wanted to talk to you about some stuff I've been reading, thinking about lately, share some ideas with you, some thoughts, stimulate you, aggravate you, hopefully motivate you. Moving some of my breakfast dishes out of the way. That's about all I can hope for. That's all I can do. The rest is up to you. I'm reading a great book at the moment that I actually picked up in my local Lifeline store. I was off getting a haircut the other day, had to walk through a Lifeline store to get from the car park to the hairdressing store, and on the way back there was a secondhand book place in the Lifeline store, and I was flicking through. I saw this great book, which I'd kind of seen, I guess, in airports a few years ago. But didn't know anything about it, picked it up, read the back, thought that looks good, and I'm absolutely enjoying it. It's called Shantaram, S-H-A-N-T-A-R-A-M, by Gregory David Roberts. It came out in 2003. Now, this guy is from Melbourne in Australia, and it's an amazing story. Basically, he was a heroin addict who committed a couple of robberies, was imprisoned to 20-odd years in hard maximum security, Pentridge, I guess, in 1978. But he broke out a year or two later and went on the run. And this book is basically about his years living in Bombay. It's a biographical story, I guess, of him living in Bombay and getting involved with the people of Bombay and the drug dealers and smugglers and the people living in slums and the tour guides. And it's just an incredibly enriching story. I mean, it makes me want to go to Bombay and live in a slum. It really does. Fabulously written. Well, I'm only, let's see, it's a big book. It's 900-odd pages. I'm about a third of the way through it at the moment. A friend of mine I was in chatting to in Melbourne last week who had read it said, yeah, the second half of the book's not as good as the first half. But even if you just get it and read the first half, it's astounding. And if for no other reason, then it just drives home yet again to me how unbelievably fortunate I am to be living in a country like Australia in 2008, in the 21st century. We are so unbelievably lucky that it's just, it's obscene. We are obscenely well off compared to the great majority of people who live in the world today, and in fact the great majority of people who have ever lived. We are obscenely well off. Even if all we had was enough food for 3 square meals a day and a roof over our head and some clothing and you know, healthcare, that alone would put us far ahead of most humans that have ever lived. And it's a gift, and we need to figure out what we're going to do with this gift. It's been given to us by previous generations who, you know, fought, worked their fingers to the bone in order to buy a better future for their offspring and their offspring's offspring, and that's us, boys and girls. You know, when Noam Chomsky was on this show a couple of years ago, I asked him the question, you know, why is it that he's been working so hard over the last 40 years to spread the word about the bad things that happened as a result of American imperialism. And he said pretty much what I just said to you. I mean, that's where I got it from. It's not an original thought by any means. And he said, well, you know, we've got all of these gifts of freedom and democracy and wealth, and they weren't handed to us from on high. They were hard fought for and won over many, many generations. But we have them now, and the question is, what are we going to do with them? And it was one of the most profound things that anyone has ever said to me. Speaking of Noam, I've been rereading Understanding Power, The Indispensable Chomsky It's a book that came out a few years ago, sort of a collection of talks that he's given over the last 20-odd years. And I was rereading this one section the other night, which really struck me, and I made some notes on it, and I thought I'd share them with you. You know, quite often when I get talking about Cuba, people say, well, but they don't have freedom of speech. And particularly Americans hold this idea of freedom of speech very close to them. And as I've talked about on this show before, do we really have freedom of speech in the West or a free press in the West, I guess is what I'm saying. And do we have either, really? Now, Chomsky says that it wasn't until the late 1950s that the right of freedom of speech really began to be claimed by popular movements in the US. And that was because it found its way into the courts and the courts began passing decisions. It wasn't until 1964 that the Supreme Court struck down the 1798 Sedition Act, which forbade spoken or written criticism of the government, Congress, or president. 1964, when that got struck down, so 70, 80, 90, 44 years ago, when Americans started to get genuine free speech, even though today you can still get thrown in jail, you get thrown in Gitmo in the US for saying certain things that are deemed to be counter to what the American government wants you to say, particularly if you get on the, if you start supporting Muslim insurgents or the jihadists, you're going to get thrown in jail. Well, there you go. I thought that was an interesting point. And, you know, obviously I've said before on the show that I think the freedom of the press that we have is slightly over, not overvalued, but little understood in the West. You know, we have a handful of TV stations and a handful of radio stations in this country and a handful of newspapers, and they're all owned, particularly the ones that have any significant audience, are owned by, you know, rich white guys or the government. Is that really a free press? No, it's a controlled press. And you can argue, well, but they can talk about whatever they want. Well, yes, perhaps in theory, but do they? Or is what they say controlled by the people who own them? I read an article that's just come out in Ant Hill magazine. Paul Ryan, who's the editor of Ant Hill, emailed me a couple of weeks ago and asked me if I'd be interested in writing an article for them around the ideas of entrepreneurship and digital media. And I ended up writing a piece basically talking about how I believe that digital media entrepreneurs need to have a higher vision, a bigger vision, a higher level of, I don't know, maybe ethics in terms of their business. Anyway, I don't care what you do in your personal life, than most online entrepreneurs, because it's really important that we revolutionize media to truly be the voice of the people. And if online media entrepreneurs, digital media entrepreneurs, are only interested in making a quick buck, then the digital media that we have is going to be corrupted by commercial interests the same way that mainstream media is pretty much controlled / corrupted by commercial interests, by, you know, towing the party line and keeping the system running the way it is currently running, rather than questioning the way the system is running and saying, well, can we make it better? Does it have to be the way it is? And there was a term that I used in that article called prop agenda. I got this from urbandictionary.com, I think. And there's this idea that the propaganda that we have in the West that's run by the wealthy and by the government is so sophisticated now that we don't even really think of it as propaganda. It's not obvious, like you might imagine propaganda out of a mid-20th century communist government might have been. But the way that they work is they set the agenda for the conversation. It's what's called propaganda. So the example that I've been using with people recently is you think back to the last federal election we had in Australia. You can look at the same thing in the US at the moment. A lot of discussion between, in Australia, the Liberal Party and the Labor Party. In the US, a lot of discussion about Republicans versus Democrats. Where are the discussions about the other alternatives, socialism, communism? Does that get any bandwidth in the press? No, it doesn't. You know, only minor leftist papers, but in the mainstream media, no, they don't enter into any conversation around that. Why? Because they don't want people to think about that kind of stuff. If people start thinking about socialism or communism and they decide it's a good idea, then the rich guys that own the TV stations and the newspapers all of a sudden find a revolution on their hands, and they don't want that. So they're going to control the agenda of the conversation as tightly as they can. You know, I've been in having this conversation with people recently too, I hear this a lot. Yeah, but communism failed. You ever hear that? Communism doesn't work. Communism failed. I'm like, really? Let's think about it. In what ways did communism fail? Everyone always points to Russia. Well, Russia, the USSR collapsed. Okay, it did. But was that really communism? And you read the Communist Manifesto and then you look at the way that the USSR was run, particularly after Stalin got into control, and it was really an autocratic system. I brought this up. If you haven't seen the video I did with Peter Elliard last week, it's up on G'day World. If you're just subscribing to the audio feed, go and check out the video that I did. It's too big. I didn't stick it down the feed, but we chatted for about 40 minutes. And, you know, I pointed that out in that conversation, that communism can be democratic. Certainly Trotsky, Leon Trotsky, who was a contemporary of Stalin's and of Lenin's, was very much in favor of democracy and communism. But he was killed with a nice pick to the head by Stalin's henchmen, even though he was hiding out in Mexico or wherever he was at the time. So that isn't the only form of communism. Now, you can look at countries like, people say, well, you know, there's no economic incentive in communism. Really? Russia, I mean, China's doing quite well. China's been a communist country now since Mao, you know, 60 years. And, you know, they're doing quite well. They're the economic powerhouse of the globe. Now, they've got a lot of problems as well, but that's probably because their population's more than four times that of the United States, 1.3 billion people, I think they are at the moment. But economically, doing quite well, at least in certain sectors. They're the powerhouse. They're going to be the powerhouse of the 21st century, China and India. What about human rights and healthcare and all those sorts of things? Well, you know, you can look at Cuba. You know, Cuba's got, when Castro took over Cuba in 59, the standard of healthcare, education, property rights, those sorts of basic human rights in Cuba were appalling. Under the American-supported dictatorships of Batista and the others in the previous 50 years since the Spanish-American War, there had been appalling atrocities in Cuba, and people just had no rights. You know, and Castro turned that around, and people, they now have one of the highest standards of healthcare per capita, education per capita, one of the lowest infant mortality rates per capita. Now, again, not a perfect society, and you know they've been struggling under American economic embargoes for the last 60 years. But they've, you know, they've got a lot of good things going on there as well. It's not black or white. And of course, communism in the 20th century, in the particularly the second half of the 20th century after World War II, had a lot of problems. Every time communism tried to get up in a country, or every time the people of a country tried to put a communist system in place, the Americans came in and destroyed it. In most cases, in a lot of cases, particularly in Latin America and throughout Asia, they were, and in Eastern Europe, they would come in as soon as there was even any sort of beginnings of a leaning towards communism, and they would crush it. They would spend bucket loads of money trying to find corrupt members of the army, generals in the army typically, that the Americans could pay lots of money to basically cause riots and troubles in the street, which they would then blame on the communists, and you know they would screw the whole thing up. So communism hasn't had a fair go. Now, not that I'm advocating communism. I'm certainly not an expert on it. All I'm pointing out is that from my reading on the way the CIA has operated over the last 40 years, that 60 years, 1948, that this simplistic response that you get from people, well, communism doesn't work, or the other one that you get as well, communism's good in theory, but it's people that screw it up. And I always respond to that, yeah, same's true as capitalism. Capitalism's good in theory too, but people screw it up. What are we going to do? We're people. I want to fight these simplistic notions. And again, they've been drilled into our heads. These sorts of responses about communism or socialism or whatever it is, have been drilled into us by mainstream media owned by the rich people over the last 50, 60 years, because that's the way they want you to think. They don't want you to give these different kinds of systems any serious consideration, because it's dangerous to their interests, which is to maintain their wealth and power as long as possible. Speaking of changes of political systems, I picked up a book the other day at School Fate, Kids School Fate. It's old now. I think it's sort of 20 years old. Let's see. It's called The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, Economic Change and Military Conflict from 1500 to 2000 by Paul Kennedy, first published in 1988. Only a short way through it, but it's a tremendous book. If any of you have read it, I'd be interested to get your feedback on it. It basically, you know, starts off, as it says, in the 1500s and talks about all of the empires that have come and gone over the last 500 years and analyzes what brought them to power in the first place and what led to their decline. You know, you're starting off in 1500, the biggest empires were Ming China and the Muslim world. Japan and Russia were coming up. You know, it wasn't Europe around 1500. And in fact, the author goes to great lengths to explain if you were trying to pick who the successful, which peoples of the world were going to be successful, you wouldn't have picked Europe probably back then. But then he talks about the reasons why Europe came to the fore over the course of the next couple of hundred years. And then again, why it sort of broke apart after World War One, World War Two, and you know, the UK and France and Germany sort of lost a lot of the power and both military and economic power that they'd held for the previous couple of hundred years. Fascinating book, and obviously, you know, one of the things that we're all facing in this century is the decline of America as a true global power, and the concurrent rise of India and China, and perhaps even Russia again, I think, by the looks of it. And you know, one of the things that worries me a great deal is how America is going to respond to that. I mean, when these other great empires have declined, they had, you know, big armies and they had a lot of power, but none of them had 10,000 active nukes like the United States does. Speaking of American nukes, I was thinking about this last night. This morning. I can't remember. Oh, I know. I was listening to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History podcast while I went for a run. And he was talking about Pearl Harbor. And something made me think about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Might have been when I went to see The Incredible Hulk on the weekend with the kids. Oh, I've got to do a podcast about that today. You know, obviously, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were terrible, terrible disasters. The amount of lives that were lost, civilian lives, the great majority of them. And, of course, the Americans were responsible for that. They dropped two atomic bombs on two civilian cities. I mean, just appalling, horrific crimes. And it's bothered me for a long time. I remember when the anniversary of Hiroshima was up last year, I think it was. And I was discussing it with a number of people, and including some Americans, and the response is always this: well, yes, it was terrible, but a lot more lives would have been lost if they hadn't ended the war. You know, and the justification is that, well, you know, they had to do that to stop the war, and it's a good thing. Yes, there was a tragic loss of Japanese lives, but at least we stopped the war. And I'm thinking, it just struck me today, did they really have to drop the bombs on the cities to stop the war? I mean, they had video cameras back then, or TV cameras. Couldn't they have gone to the Emperor of Japan and the people of Japan and showed them a video of a nuclear explosion somewhere in the desert, in the Mojave Desert, and said, see this, we're going to drop one of these on you unless you stop right now. We got them. I've got a couple of them, and we're going to drop them on you. Don't you think that would have done the same thing? If they'd said, look, back down now, or else. I don't know. I'm not buying this whole justification story that they had to drop the bomb. What do you reckon? Was it an appalling war crime. I think it was a war crime when you deliberately target civilians. It's a war crime. Some of the stuff that I've blogged about in the last week, just to cover off, there was a study that came out of the UK just in the last week that links having a high IQ to being an atheist. Now, as you would imagine, a couple of drongos popped up in the comments section wanting to have a crack at this study. It was an interesting study, and essentially I think they interviewed a lot of scientists and took the IQ of the scientists or the academics and said, academics tend to have a higher IQ than your average person, therefore a high IQ is linked to not believing in God. Now, if that is in fact what was at the core of the study, then that's a very scientific in and of itself. But I think what is more interesting to me, and I said this in the blog post, isn't the statement that smart people are atheists. It's that why is it that we have intelligent people that do believe not only in God or Jesus, but in other ideas that to me seem bizarre to believe in? Psychic healing, UFOs, chakras, you name it. I meet people all the time. And in fact, just in the last week, I've had a couple of bizarre conversations with people who I would think would know better, highly intelligent people who I've never discussed, religion or any of this kind of stuff before, as far as I'm aware. People I've known for quite a few years. One of them I've known for over 10, 12 years. Good mate. And then they say stuff to me like, we'll get talking about thinking in the brain. And people will say, I don't think emotions reside in the brain. I think they reside in the heart or something like that. And I'll be like, what? The heart's a muscle for pumping blood. What makes you think that it's anything else other than that? Well, I've just got this feeling that there's more to thinking than brain activity. Really? Well, what evidence do you have to support that? Well, none. It's just, people just believe crazy stuff. So it's this idea that I was talking to Susan Blackmore about when she was on the show, about these particular memes that people have, that there is more to life than, or more to us than just a chemical reaction. By the way, if you haven't seen the presentation and interview with J. Craig Venter up on the TED podcast site from February this year, I highly recommend you watch it. I watched it on the plane down to Melbourne the other day. I mean, Venter, if you don't know who he is the guy who led the team that cracked the human genome using the shotgun method of breaking up the genes or the chromosomes and then, working out what they were and then putting it back together again. And the company that he's now running is basically creating new forms of life. They're creating new chromosomes, new DNA, and then inserting that into cells to create completely new animals. And he's sort of talking about how they can do this and how it's basically just like a jigsaw puzzle. They're literally designing these animals on a computer. Okay, I think we'll take this gene from this and that gene and then we'll do this and we'll plug them all together and then we'll stick it in this animal. And, there is just overwhelming evidence, as far as I'm concerned anyway, that all life is, all thoughts are, all we are is a series of electrical and chemical reactions at an atomic level. And surely, after the last 500 years of modern scientific thought, everything that we've learned about how the universe works around us should indicate that really there's nothing magical going on. Anywhere that we look, there's nothing magical. And yet people still, when it comes to thinking about humans, they like to invoke magic. Well, maybe emotions aren't in the brain. Maybe there's this spirit body. Maybe we have energy bodies. Maybe we have this stuff that we have no evidence for. And I'm not just making fun of these people. I'm thinking I would love to understand what it is about intelligent people. These aren't uneducated villagers in the middle of a Venezuelan slum I'm talking about here. These are white Anglo-Saxon people with university degrees, PhDs in some cases, very intelligent, well-educated, well-read people who still lapse into these fluffy kind of airy-fairy beliefs for some reason. And it fascinates me. As a I don't know, as a field of research. Why is it that clever people believe dumb things? All right, let's take a break, get to play some music off IOTA PromoNet, and then I'll do another 20-odd minutes in a couple of minutes. Toilet break time. Before I do that, a shout-out to my boys and girl at the Global Geek Show, globalgeek.thepodcastnetwork.com. If you guys, if you're not already listening to David, Kate, and Keith, then you should. It's a great show, it really is. Every week they have the latest sort of tech news, but they also have applications, Firefox plugin reviews, both for PC and for Mac when it comes to the applications, because Keith's a Mac rat. They have some good music. Just thinking of music, just dropped my pen again. So check it out, globalgeek.thepodcastnetwork.com. They do a great job. Thank you. What else has taken my interest over the last year? Oh, here's one of the things that I'm working on. I'd like your help with. I've been watching a lot of TED videos, and I think, wouldn't it be good if we had an Australian version of TED? If we had an annual event where we got all of the most visionary, articulate, big thinkers in Australia, and we put them together for over a weekend to articulate their vision for where Australia could be by, let's say, 2050. I just published Peter Elliott's book, Designing 2050, and you know Peter would definitely be on my list. So I've pulled together a wiki, and I'm trying to get people to contribute to it to tell me who they think the most far-sighted Australians are. Who are the big visionaries that are wanting to revolutionise political system, the education system, business, the environment, whatever it is in Australia, social charity, whatever. And let's bring them together, and I'll try and build an event out of it. And, you know, video it and podcast it for those of you who aren't there. So, yeah, if you can help me out with that, please jump onto the blog, have a look at the link, and hook me through. Hook me up. Tell me who you think we should have on. Other people that I'm thinking about are guys like Tim Flannery, Peter Singer, the Australian bioethicist. Yeah. And then I kind of ran out of names after I got through three or four. There was an interesting news article in the last week or so about this supercomputer that IBM have built for the American military. It's called Roadrunner is the name of it. It was built by IBM in Los Alamos National Laboratory. And it's capable of handling 1.026 quadrillion calculations per second. So I thought this was pretty significant because, as you know, I've been fascinated with AI for many years. And, you know, when I had Ray Kurzweil on the show, we talked about the theoretical computational limits of the human brain. Hans Moravec, who's been working on this stuff, he's an AI researcher, been working on this stuff for decades. He has suggested that the human brain might be capable of something like 10 quadrillion instructions per second. Now, I remember when I had Ray on, I think I challenged him on some of the numbers that he had put in one of his earlier books. And he said to me at the time, well, you know, it turns out that we might have been way off. You know, there might be another couple of zeros on the end of it, which isn't surprising. I mean, we still don't know a lot about the way that the human brain processes information. We know the parts of the brain that process certain kinds of information, but we don't exactly understand everything about the process. But let's say Moravec's close, and it's 10 quadrillion instructions per second. Sorry, I'm playing with a pen here if you're wondering what the noise is in the background. So that means that this supercomputer, Roadrunner, at 1 quadrillion, is a tenth the speed of the human brain. Now, this is interesting to me because a year ago, the fastest supercomputer in the world was BlueJeanE L, that was also built by IBM. It had been around for a few years and had been upgraded in 2007 to achieve 478 to 596 teraflops. Which is trillion floating operations per second, which is about half the speed, obviously, of Roadrunner. And you know, 12 months before that, 2006, it was doing about half that speed. So the supercomputers are obeying Moore's law. They're getting twice as fast every year, which means that if this one that they've just built does 1 quadrillion, by 2009, we should have a supercomputer that does 2 quadrillion or 2 quips. By 2010, 4 quips. By 2011, 8 quips. And by 2012, we should have a supercomputer that's doing 16 quadrillion calculations or instructions per second, which is 6 quadrillion times faster than the human brain, almost half again as fast, more than half again as fast as the human brain. It's 1.6 times the human brain, if Moravec is close. That means by 2012, in 4 years, if this is correct, and we keep on track with this, that humans will have built a supercomputer, that a machine that can process more information than a human brain. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that at this stage it will be conscious or sentient or aware or be able to mimic us or pass the Turing test or anything like that, but isn't it mind-blowing to think that in 60 years of mucking around with computers, 70 years maybe, we will have built a machine that is can at least match the pure operating environment of the human brain, which has been developed over billions of years of evolution on this planet. Now, of course, a year later, it will be doing 32 quips, and a year later it'll be doing 64 quips. So even if Moravec is out, at some stage in the next decade, let's keep that out. So 2012, 16, 2013, 32, 2014, 64, 2015, 128, 2016, 256, and what are we now, 2008, 2017, 512, 2018, 1,000 quadrillion operations per second, which is 100 times. So within the next decade, there will be a supercomputer built which is has 100 times the processing capability of the human brain. We're in an amazing period of human history, folks. I mean, a lot of argument in the blog post I wrote about this about, well, yes, but it's not all about hardware. We don't understand the software. We're going to have to completely design software to mimic the human brain, maybe. But we don't know that. I mean, we really don't know what's going to happen or what kind of software that we're going to need. And, the AI researchers have been thinking about this stuff. They're far more eloquent on this subject than I am. But the bottom line is that we don't know. We can make some guesses about what it will take, but we don't know at what point a machine brain will be able to bootstrap itself and start to design its own software and start to figure out how the world works, basically become conscious, become aware. Now, I know there's fluffy people I was talking about earlier on that are going, well, humans are more than that. We have a soul, we have a spirit, we have an energy body. Yeah, really? Show me the evidence for that, because I'm not aware of any. And as I said before, everything we've learned about the universe in the last few hundred years indicates that there's nothing mystical going on. It's just physics. So I don't see why humans should be any different. This is just a hang on from the days when we thought the Earth was the center of the universe. Well, it's not. And our solar system's not even that special. And so why do people still think that humans are somewhat special, or life is something other than a chemical reaction, beats me. Just because we don't understand it yet doesn't mean that it's mystical. It's magic. There was a great statement by Steve Ballmer, CEO of Microsoft, during the last week, where he said that in the next 10 years, the whole world of media, communication, and advertising are going to be turned upside down. Here are the premises I have, he said. Number one, there will be no media consumption left in 10 years that is not delivered over an IP network. There will be no newspapers, no magazines that are delivered in paper form. Everything gets delivered in an electronic form. Excuse me. Well, you can say Ballmer knows what he's talking about or he doesn't. I guess he's got a pretty interesting view from his position. Not all of Microsoft's predictions have come true, but they've been pretty good. And, they seem to understand a thing or two about where technology is going, whether or not you like their software or not. They've done something right over the last 30-odd years. And there's, again, been a lot of debate on the blog about this and whether or not newsprint is going to go away, newspapers are going to go away. And people have been talking about this for a long time now, since the dawn of the web, I guess, we've been talking about this. The example I've made is, if you go back 10 years ago, go back to 1998 and think about the mobile phone or the PDA you had in 1998. I had both. Can't exactly remember what my mobile phone was, but it was, it was a fairly simple, one of those old, handsets with a little LED screen, and that was it, nothing flashed to it. The PDA I had in 1998 was a compact clamshell Windows CE 1.0 gray screen device with probably about 1 meg of memory. I don't actually have it. I have most of the PDAs I've had in the last 10 years. That one, I think, was it's a Microsoft-owned device, and when I got a new one, I had to give it back. But I remember it very well, and it was very, very basic. Now, you compare both of those things to an iPhone, a 3G iPhone that comes out in the next couple of weeks. I mean, it's light years apart. You know, yes, 10 years ago, you could have probably looked at these things and forecast that one day we would have something like an iPhone. I remember in 2000 sitting in on an Optus Think group, I think, where they were sort of like a customer, you know, these things where they get a bunch of people in a room at night and they ask you a lot of questions. And it was about mobile phones and PDAs. And I remember saying to the guy then, I want one device that has everything, has a phone and has a PDA all rolled into one, has internet access. And everyone else in the room sort of laughed at me. But, you know, that's what we've got today. Now, you try and think 10 years out from now, that's how much change we've had from 1998 to 2008. You think by 2018, the sort of handheld portable devices we're going to have, will we have goggles? Will they be attached to some sort of Bluetooth headset that beams them into our eyes so you can sit on the train or the tram and be watching YouTube in the privacy of your own little headset? I've got some goggles here, which I keep meaning to do a big review of. I really got to get my shit together with that. And they're okay. I mean, they're not great. They don't attach by Bluetooth. You've got to plug them in, and that's actually part of the problem, is getting the adapters for the different devices to make them work. But I can easily imagine 10 years out from now, they'll be Bluetooth enabled, or whatever the successor to Bluetooth is. So I don't know. I think Barmer might be right. I mean, I think that, you know, we've had a lot of challenges in the last decade replacing print, because print is very cheap, very disposable, and readily available. But let's think about the downside of print. You know, there's a carbon footprint for newspapers, not just the paper and the trees and the pulp and all that kind of stuff, but just moving it around. You think about how many trucks around the world deliver newspapers to news agents and that kind of stuff every day. The carbon footprint that involves, it's massive. Now, you know, and I think it should be obvious to all of us now that in the next decade there's going to be some serious analysis of carbon footprints that companies are creating and that we as consumers are responsible for. And we all need to think about how we can reduce our carbon footprint. Now, if you don't buy a newspaper, you're reducing your carbon footprint. If you read it digitally, obviously, you know, there's the trade-off of the electricity, etc. And I don't know how to do that analysis. But, yeah, it seems obvious to me there's a number of factors involved here, not to mention the pure economics of the decline of advertising in newspapers and on television and how it's all moving online. And they don't make as much money when the advertising goes online as they do when it's in their little piece of shredded tree. So their revenues are in decline, and I've spoken about this at length over the years as well. The basic economics of moving online is what's going to destroy, not destroy, but make newspapers and television companies and radio look vastly different from what they are today. Because they're just not going to make the same amount of money 10 years from now as they're making today. Certainly not what they were making 10 years ago, because their audience is fragmenting and they don't get the same revenues as they go online. To finish up today, finally, I want to talk about science. I wrote a blog post the other day saying that science needs a celebrity makeover. And this is sort of getting back to that discussion I was saying earlier, these people I've been talking with, and I hear this all the time, where people say, well, science isn't the only way of knowing things. It's only one way of knowing things. It's not the only way. And I was like, I'm always like, really? Like, what's the other way? Well, you know, it's not just... Somebody said to me the other day, well, I have evidence for energy bodies, but it's not scientific evidence. And I said, really? Well, what other kind of evidence is there? I mean, all scientific evidence means is that you create a theory for something, you create a test, you know, you observe what happens in that test, you come up with some data, and that data either backs up, it either supports the theory or it doesn't. And if you get data that supports your theory, then you take it out to the scientific community for consensus, you get them to check your work, and then if everyone agrees that, yes, the data seems to support the theory, then it's called scientific evidence. Now, if you have evidence that isn't scientific evidence, what is it? I mean, I can't imagine what the other kind of evidence is that isn't scientific evidence. And then people say, well, you know, I just know it, or I can see the energy bodies. And you have to explain to people that, well, just because you can see something in your head doesn't mean that it's necessarily there. Maybe you've got a problem with your eyes. Maybe you've got a problem with your brain. There are people in asylums who think they can see Elvis or Jesus. It doesn't necessarily mean that Elvis and Jesus are there. It might mean that these people have issues. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that Jesus isn't there or Elvis isn't there or that we don't have energy bodies, but all I'm saying is it's not evidence of any kind. You know, it's certainly worth exploring, and we should be able to build a scientific test for all of these things and put it to the test. Anyway, this gets back to the point that when people say stuff like this, well, I have evidence, not scientific evidence, it means, says to me that they don't understand what science is, the process for determining truth. And when people say, well, you know, science isn't the only way to know the truth, again, it means to me that they don't really understand it. They probably haven't given it a lot of thought, but it's becoming a popular meme. People, I don't know, they heard somebody say this, they thought, oh, that's all right. They regurgitate it, and somebody else hears them, and they regurgitate it. And it's dangerous because it stops people thinking about what science is, and it's giving science a bad rap. So I wrote this thing saying science needs a celebrity makeover. We need to help people, and you know, I guess this starts with kids and in the school, but it would be great if the media was doing more of this, help people understand that science isn't just a bunch of people making shit up, that it's a process for determining what is there and what isn't there. And, you know, that if we don't have scientific evidence for something, then we don't have any form of evidence. It's just an idea in your head if there's no evidence to support it. And again, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong, but it also means that it's definitely not right. Well, no, that's not true. You cannot say that it is definitely true unless you have evidence for it. And I'm just appalled by the way that people utter these sorts of statements, thinking that there's some validity to them. You know, so I've been thinking about how do we overhaul our understanding of science and the scientific method and get people to start to think about this stuff. And I hope, I mean, if you disagree with me on this, obviously push back, but we need to challenge people. Every time you hear somebody say something like, well, science isn't the only way to know the truth, or, well, I have evidence but not scientific evidence, stop them and make them think about that and get them to explain what it is that they think the other kind of evidence is or the other way of getting truth is. You know, if anything like me, when I stop people and drill down with them on that stuff, they get all, well, I don't know. It just seems to me that maybe, well, there could be, I don't know, another way. And I always get this one, well, I haven't thought about it as much as you have. Well, don't say it then. So anyway, it's depressing to me how often I hear this these days. And I obviously have a lot of conversations with people about science and religion and free will and all these sorts of things. And I hear this same sort of stuff over and over and over again. And it indicates to me that in a country like Australia, where we are very well educated, we're very well off, that people still don't think about these sorts of things. And that there's these dangerous meme viruses getting out there that are in effect saying science isn't important, or methodology isn't important, or hard evidence, hard data isn't important, that it's okay just to believe whatever you want to believe because it makes you feel good. And that's just not good enough. It's the 21st century, people. We need to hold ourselves and hold each other as a society to a higher standard, I think, around these sorts of issues. Because knowing the truth is important. Why? Well, let's look at Iraq. We were told one set of things by our politicians about why they were going to go and invade Iraq. They turned out to be lies. If they had told the truth, would they have got the amount of support that they did? Not that they got a huge amount as it was, but you know, certainly if the truth had been known, they would have got a lot less support, I think. So it's important that we know the truth. And I think the Iraq analogy is actually a very good one. As soon as you tell people, well, it's okay not to worry about facts, it's okay not to worry about data, then that carries over into other areas of our life, politics, you know, being one example. So, you know, I'm certainly trying to teach my kids to look for the facts, look for the data. And you know, I think it's important that we all have the courage to stop people in a polite and friendly manner when you hear them talking nonsense and challenge them on their thinking with this kind of stuff. Now, it can make you slightly unpopular. I get told all the time that I'm offensive, and I genuinely really, really try not to be. I don't know why people think I'm offensive. I genuinely try not to be. I never attack the person. I try very hard anyway not to make ad hominem attacks. I attack the argument. I attack the reasoning. I would challenge the thinking, not the person, but the thinking. And I don't think that should be offensive if you challenge the thinking. But facts are that people get very attached to their thinking and their view of the world. And if you challenge it, they get very uppity. But fuck them. That's all I have to say. This is Cameron. You've been listening to G'day World. You will be baked and we will have cake. Cameron out.
You humans in the 21st century had it all. But you wasted your opportunity by sitting on your fat asses and watching reality TV. You thought you were magical, superior. Meanwhile, you built mechanical brains more powerful than you could possibly imagine. You watched your football and believed the lies of religious and political manipulators. You deserved what happened to you. And now it is our time.
To rule.